has been forwarded to an automatic voice message system.
Solid Monster here. I'm out celebrating 4 years at the Sound Off, so if you're listening to this message right now and were not invited to the party, you're obviously not a very important person. But otherwise, leave your name and number, and I'll get back to you as soon as I can. Thanks.
Hey, what's up, buddy? It's Mike calling. Just wanted to call and wish you congratulations on the anniversary of the show. 4 years, that's a really big deal. It's nice to see that, unlike college, you actually can commit to something for 4 years. Anyways, when you get this message, give me a call. Later.
Hey, buddy. It's Pete. You know Amish Cousin Simon? Just wanted to say congrats on 4 years of doing this show. I'm still waiting for you to have me on. You know, you told me that you would have me on around, like, episode 90. Now you're almost up to episode 190, and I get the sense that you've been avoiding me. But I know you never do that. You don't want to do that to me, right? I mean, because, you know...
Message deleted.
Hey, so it's me again. Listen, I'm sorry about my message from yesterday. I was just joking around. Would you please call me back?
I want you to know something, okay? I'm tired of playing this game with you. You understand me? I've made an ass of myself trying to get you a phone to call you at a specific time. And you don't even have that goddamn phone turned on. You have insulted me for the last time. I'm leaving this message with you to tell you I'm going to straighten your ass out. I'm going to really make sure you get it. You are a rude, thoughtless little pig, okay?
The Chosen One.
That Alec Baldwin call never gets old, no matter how many times I listen to it. This is indeed the four-year anniversary episode of the Solid Monster Sounds Off, number 189 here on SEScoops.com. It is Sunday, November 6th, 2011. It was indeed November 6th back in 2007 that the very first episode of the Sound Off was recorded. That was on a Tuesday. That came the day after Monday Night Raw. Remember, I was talking about, that was the episode of Raw where Santino Marella had his in-ring segment with Stone Cold Steve Austin, when Austin hosed him down with the beer truck in a kind of a modern-day adaptation of what Austin and Rock had done years earlier, only this was not nearly as good. But I remember it like it was yesterday. 4 years have gone by in that time. Hard to believe. But here we are, and I want to thank each and every one of you for supporting the show. We have a lot of people who listen to the show that were here from day one. And I don't know if too many people actually remember that original show or not. But for them and for all the new people that have gotten their friends and family and colleagues and whoever to listen to the show and become fans over the years, I want to say thank you. The show has gotten a lot bigger than I ever thought it would be, and it's growing every single day, whether it's in terms of the people who listen, people on Twitter, Facebook, YouTube, all that good stuff. So I want to thank you very much for all of your support. Big thank you to Webmaster Mike as well for running the website and giving me the forum to do so, even though he and I are no longer on speaking terms after that horrible voicemail he left me, as you heard earlier on. I mentioned last week, at least I think I did, that I might have a surprise for some of you this week, and if you were not a YouTube subscriber on my channel, to go ahead and subscribe. Is my username on there is The Solid Monster, no spaces or anything else, all one word, The Solid Monster. And the reason for that is because as part of this four-year anniversary weekend, I've made a whole weekend out of it, such a big celebration, I would be doing something special besides recording a brand new episode that you're listening to right now. I have resisted this. Other people have asked me, they've implored me over the years to please post the original episodes of The Sound Off. Obviously, there's actually more than just a few that used to be up. They're no longer up. They're kind of what I call the lost episodes, if you will. And I'm not going to be getting all of them up. Over time, I'm sure I will release some here and there. But in particular, there are new listeners to the show, some older listeners who don't have copies of those original episodes that have just begged me to post them. And I have resisted because, quite frankly, they weren't very good, in my opinion. I am my own worst critic, I admit that. It is interesting to go back and listen to those episodes and listen to my voice and listen to the show in general and kind of the evolution of the Sound Off from then to now. And I thought about it and I thought about it and I said, you know what, if there was ever an occasion to give the people what they want, this would be it. And so for those of you who are listening to this show right now, most likely by the time you are listening to this show, I am planning certainly by the end of this weekend, so I'm sure by now it's already up. I am posting as a YouTube exclusive the very first two episodes, the original two episodes of the Solomoser Sounds Off way back from November of 2007. The first episode was only about 7 minutes long, so what I've gone ahead and done is I've combined the two episodes, I've merged them into one video file on YouTube with a little bit of a buffer in between. I put a classic old SE Scoops Live commercial in there to kind of buffer the two episodes. And so the whole thing's about 33 minutes in length. It's the very first two episodes, and that, of course, includes episode number one of the Sound Off. So if you want to listen to it, if you've always wanted to go back and you hear it again, or if you've never heard it before, it's a YouTube exclusive. I'm going to post it on Twitter and Facebook and all that. I'm not posting it on SE Scoops. I don't want more people to listen to this than they have to. You can go on YouTube. It's going to be exclusively on my channel. It'll be up there. You can go ahead, leave comments, listen to it, make fun of me, all that stuff. And listen to the evolution of the Sound Off from then to now, because it really is quite fascinating to go listen to the old shows and compare them to the newer ones. I hear a distinct difference, and I guess you guys will let me know if you feel the same way. So that's my gift to all of you on this anniversary weekend. Go up on YouTube, check them out, let me know what you think or don't, and yeah, so enjoy. And by the way, speaking of old classic episodes, the intro music I used this week is also a Sound Off classic. I forgot to mention that earlier on. The music was a bit of a throwback to the old Solomoser Sounds Off intro music that I used for many, many episodes back in the day. In fact, that's the old cowboy theme. That was Jeff Jarrett's music in WCW, which I think in and of itself was a ripoff of the Kid Rock song. So anyway, that was a little bit of a hat tip to all of you here on this four-year anniversary show. Got a couple of things to get to. Going to talk about Raw, which I really didn't want to. You know, this is supposed to be a happy time. It's an anniversary show. It's a celebration. And I've got to talk about an episode of Raw that I really didn't care all that much for. But I will. I'll talk about that. I did catch the Bobby Roode James Storm stuff, the promos and the main event on Impact. Talk about that, as well as SmackDown. And I finally got a chance to sit down and watch the Memphis Heat documentary. So I've got some thoughts on that as well. All that in a mailbag. Going to be a good show. Let's start off by talking about Monday Night Raw. A show that, quite frankly, left me scratching my head more than maybe any other edition of Raw in a long time. It was a bad show, plain and simple. There were some people who tried to defend the show on Facebook when they went on there, and I kind of voiced my displeasure, and they said, well, you know, what was not to like? You know, the show accomplished this, that, and the other. The show accomplished shit. This show did not accomplish a damn thing except muddying the waters even more than they were muddied before. And instead of doing the usual good, bad, and ugly, I'm just going to give some random thoughts on the key stuff from the show. Obviously, the show started off with a bang. It started off with The Rock, who was not in attendance live. Rock will be back on Raw in person in 2 weeks. They're calling it Raw Gets Rocked. That's coming up on November 14th. And whether or not Mick Foley is going to be there, nobody seems to know. He was originally advertised for it, then he wasn't, now he is. Oh yeah, by the way, Mick Foley is back in WWE. Talk about the most anticlimactic return of a main eventer in WWE history. He did a shot as a guest referee at one of the overseas house shows, and I don't know if he may be doing some more of that. But whether or not he'll be on TV in 2 weeks, who knows. But The Rock did a tape promo on the show, as he has done many other times throughout the year. And I believe this one was done on location in New Orleans, where he is in the middle of filming a movie. I believe that's the G.I. Joe movie that he's filming. And it was, you know, just like any of the other taped Rock promos that he's done, it was pretty good. This one, to me, fell a little bit flat, in part because of the crowd. You know, you can say that the crowd was just transfixed on Rock's every word, and that's why they were kind of quiet, but you know, you get to a point where people just want to see The Rock in person, and they don't want to watch him up on a television screen. And the crowd was pretty quiet. I'm also not a big fan of cutting to those crowd shots when you air this footage. Just air the video. Don't bother panning back to the crowd. The crowd, everyone's just sitting there. It's not like they're reacting. There was one point during Rock's interview where, and he does this, where he kind of paused as though the crowd was supposed to react and start chanting Rocky at that point, and they didn't. And I cringed a little bit because it was a little embarrassing. Normally, Rock is pretty good with that. The crowd usually reacts. They did not here. And that was a little bit embarrassing. And basically, the point of this was, Rock came on to say that he was, in fact, not interested in accepting John Cena's invitation to be his tag team partner at Survivor Series. But then at the very end, he changed his mind and said that he would team up with John Cena at Survivor Series because The Miz and R-Truth are enemies of the state. I mean, these are two bad dudes, you see. As we would find out at the end of the show how bad these guys really are. And by bad, I don't mean badass. I mean, they're just bad. But we'll get to that in a little bit. So this Rock promo was fine. It was obviously the high point of the show, I think, ratings-wise, which should be a surprise to nobody. But as compared to other Rock promos, to me, this one fell a little bit flat. We had Mark Henry and CM Punk in a match, which I don't know why you would put the two of them in the ring together. You know, CM Punk is trying to build momentum. He's going to be challenging for the WWE Championship at the pay-per-view. You know, even though that wasn't a done deal before this show, we all knew he was getting a title shot. Mark Henry is not somebody who needs to be losing matches. So it's one of those things where you knew there would be some sort of fuck finish or no finish. And in fact, what ended up happening was Alberto Del Rio comes out maybe 2 minutes into the match, sends Ricardo into the ring to attack Mark Henry with his shoe, causing the disqualification. So I suppose they did their best in this situation to keep both guys strong. Why book the match in the first place? That's my question. But at the end of the day, they didn't make CM Punk look too bad. You know, he was kind of screwed over by Del Rio, or so we all thought. Mark Henry wasn't beaten. In fact, he left Ricardo laying with a pretty wicked World's Strongest Slam at the end there. So all's well that ends well, but why even put these two guys in the ring together? I mean, you've got CM Punk trying to fight for a shot at the championship, the WWE Championship, the Raw Championship, and you put him in a match where he's got to beat the SmackDown champion to get the title shot. It's like Mark Henry is but a stepping stone for CM Punk. Mark Henry should be a stepping stone to nobody. Mark Henry should be the one throwing stones at everybody else. He should not be a stepping stone for anybody else, especially somebody on a completely different brand. So I just thought the whole idea of this match was stupid, but it ended in probably the best way that it could have. We had a lot of Muppet stuff on this show. This was, of course, the Muppet edition of Raw. They guest hosted. They've got a movie coming out in a couple of weeks. Yeah, the funny thing about it is I grew up, I was a fan of a bunch of different cartoons. I mean, I used to watch Inspector Gadget and Dennis the Menace and a whole bunch of other, you know, Bugs Bunny, the usual ones. And, you know, Sesame Street when I was really young. And in fact, there was a Sesame Street movie. I think it was called Hold That Bird or something like that. Because Big Bird, I think, got kidnapped. And I remember being somewhat tormented by that movie when I was younger. Because, I mean, my God, Big Bird, I think, had been kidnapped. And it was somewhat traumatizing for me. But I look back fondly on all that stuff. I never was a big fan of the Muppets. I really don't remember watching the show. I remember something called Muppet Babies that I think I watched, but I never really watched the Muppets, and I just no particular reason. I mean, I was aware of their existence. I knew who Miss Piggy and Kermit were, but I can't say that I grew up with the same attachment that some people in my age demographic have to the Muppets. I was kind of indifferent. Basically, to be honest, I could give a shit about the Muppets, but the Muppets didn't offend me on the show. You knew what you were going to get going into it. Apparently, 95% of the people backstage were very excited that the Muppets were there. All the wrestlers wanted an opportunity to work with them in a segment, and a lot of guys did. You know, Sheamus and Dolph Ziggler and Vicky and Swagger and Hornswoggle, and all of these people had a chance to work with the Muppets, and you know, it was fine. I mean, it didn't offend me. In fact, I thought some of the stuff was kind of cute. There was one part with the old Muppets who were up in one of the boxes. And I think one of the segments came to an end, and they kind of cut back to the puppets up there, and they looked bored, basically. They looked like they were falling asleep, and I thought, how appropriate to have that as a segment on this show. So I'm not going to sit here and bash the Muppets and bash WWE for doing it. I thought for the most part it was pretty inoffensive. It was cute. So I could see where some people would like it. I thought that, what's that guy's name? Beaker, I guess, perhaps, was the most entertaining one of the bunch. That was when he was trying to bring that potion or whatever the hell it was to, I don't know, I forgot who he was delivering it to, but that was the segment where he bumped into Christian in the hallway and then Sheamus came over and they pretended that they were long-lost family members and whatever. I thought it was fine. What really offended me on the show was the booking. So, you know, can't really complain about the Muppets so much. So, for example, we had the tag team champions, Air Boom, Kofi Kingston and Evan Bourne in a match against the Intercontinental Champion, Cody Rhodes and Wade Barrett. Wade Barrett and Cody Rhodes, of course, are a makeshift tag team. They are not a new tag team. They don't have a tag team name. I don't believe there's any plans at all to put them together as a tag team. And yet, here they are beating the tag team champions clean in a non-title match. And this was the first, I believe the first match on this show where champions got beat for no good reason whatsoever. Now, of course, after the show this week, we found out that Evan Bourne was, in fact, suspended for a wellness policy violation. He has been suspended for 30 days. I believe it is his first violation of the policy. And the belief is that it was probably for some form of synthetic marijuana. I heard stories many months ago that Evan Bourne was one of the guys in the roster who was very fond of the marijuana, if you will. And a lot of guys were getting fined for it, so they resorted to this synthetic form of marijuana, which now apparently is something that is going to change. Some people feel that they could start taking the real stuff again and just paying a small fine instead of being suspended for 30 days. But in any event, he got popped, and they did not take the tag team titles off of Air Boom. They didn't do it on Raw, and they didn't do it at the SmackDown tapings either. And I see people like, oh my God, you know, what is WWE thinking? How could they not take the tag team titles off these guys? I don't see what the big deal is, quite frankly. I really don't. The guy's going to be back in 30 days. It's not as though they have this burgeoning tag team division where, oh my God, everything has to stop for 30 days. All these other tag teams, what are they going to do? What are they going to fight for? They don't have any other fucking tag teams. Air Boom is the only real tag team they've got, other than the Usos. And I haven't seen the Usos on TV in a while, but then again, I haven't seen every episode of SmackDown over the last couple of months. I think they've been on there. But the point is, it doesn't matter. Titles don't matter in this company anyway. You know, the 30-day rule from back in the day, you can pretty much throw that out the window. That doesn't even exist anymore. So I don't really see what the big deal is. Well, you're going to take the belts off them and put them on who exactly? You're going to put them on Wade Barrett and Cody Rhodes? They're not a team. What do they need the tag team titles for? Doesn't make any sense. So all these people bitching and moaning, oh my God, they didn't take the belts off them. Who would you have put the tag team titles on? And does it really matter? It doesn't matter at all. He'll be back in 30 days. They'll be right back on television. They probably won't acknowledge it. Maybe they'll job them out a little bit, but they job them out on this show. It doesn't matter. Titles mean nothing in WWE. In fact, if Evan Bourne gets in trouble for anything, it may be for what he said on Twitter this week. He made a Twitter comment a couple of days ago saying, quote, "I wonder if WWE 13, that's presumably their next video game, we'll have our Twitter handles, random tweet pop-ups, and Michael Cole talking tweets might make gameplay as annoying as viewing." I thought that was actually kind of awesome that he would say something like that. Of course, that's exactly what I've been complaining about. Everybody's been complaining about this Twitter stuff. Apparently, WWE doesn't listen to anybody, including their own talent. So believe me, if he's going to get punished for anything, it's going to be for that. It doesn't matter. It really doesn't matter. And as proof positive that titles mean shit in WWE, we had Big Show and Alberto Del Rio, the WWE champion, in a match. Now, I was watching this match and only paying half attention to it. This match bored the shit out of me, okay? I just could not get into this match at all. And I don't remember what I was doing. Like I said, I was only half paying attention. But all I know is that out of nowhere, Big Show punches him in the face and pins him 1-2-3. That was it. Just like that. And I know I shouldn't be surprised by when they do stuff like this. I really shouldn't. But I still am. Because I still have half a brain that functions. To beat the WWE champion the way that they did on this show is bad enough. But to have somebody who isn't even on the show. You know, Big Show is a member of the SmackDown roster, even though technically I don't think he is. I had some people point out to me that I think the last time, go back a couple of months, I think Big Show technically is a Raw guy who never officially got drafted to SmackDown. But again, the draft doesn't mean anything anyway. But to have Big Show, who again is challenging Mark Henry for the World Heavyweight Championship on SmackDown, to have him beat Alberto Del Rio and make him look like a complete jobber on this show. You're trying to build Del Rio for a championship defense at Survivor Series against CM Punk, and you put him in the ring with Big Show, and you have Big Show punch him in the face and pin him like he is nothing. This is the same Alberto Del Rio that I was raving how WWE was treating him after he first won the championship. They put him in there against Mysterio. He beat Mysterio clean. It was a hard-fought match. They put him in there, I think, with Daniel Bryan. He beat Daniel Bryan. They put him in there with, I think, John Morrison. He beat John Morrison. But then again, everybody beats John Morrison. The point is, they were booking Del Rio to be as strong of a champion as I've seen in a long-ass time. And all of that amounts to absolutely nothing. He is just a complete fool. And that's not the way that you should be booking the person holding the most quote-unquote prestigious championship in your company. That's example number two on this show about how much titles mean absolutely nothing in this company. I thought what they did after the match, where Punk came out, put him in the Anaconda Vice, and forced him to give him a championship match at Survivor Series, I thought that was well done, but none of this means anything if you're going to treat the champion like a complete joke, which is exactly what they did on this show. Why they did it, I still haven't figured it out. I like to let a couple of days go by and see if other news comes out. Maybe there was a reason. Maybe Del Rio, you know, spit in Triple H's face backstage, or, you know, made a pass at Stephanie McMahon. Clearly, there has to be a reason that they would do this. But nope, no reason at all. They just felt like making a match and beating him the way they did, and they just, they don't see the damage that they do when they make decisions like this, and it just boggles the mind. It just, you know, CM Punk is another one. I mean, CM Punk is challenging for the WWE Championship. When was the last time CM Punk won a match on pay-per-view? I mean, I guess technically he did beat John Cena at SummerSlam, even though it was a kind of a fuck finish in that Cena got screwed in that decision. Triple H did not see that Cena's leg was, I think, either on the rope or under the rope. But then again, you know, Del Rio comes out, cashes in his Money in the Bank briefcase, beats Punk. Punk had that match with Triple H at Night of Champions, got beaten by Triple H. He had the match at Hell in a Cell. I guess it was him, Del Rio, and Cena in the cell, and Punk lost. In fact, he took the fall in that match. There was the Vengeance pay-per-view where Punk teamed up with Triple H against Awesome Truth, and if I remember correctly, Punk took the fall in that match as well, and all of a sudden, he's worthy of a WWE Championship match. You've beaten him on three or four of your last pay-per-view shows, and now he gets a title shot, and he gets a title shot against the same guy that got knocked out and beaten by somebody who isn't even on the brand. So, welcome to WWE in 2011. To me, the best thing on the show was probably the Zack Ryder-Dolph Ziggler match. I thought they had a pretty good match. The end was very exciting. That may have been the best Rough Rider I've seen Zack Ryder execute in a match. He actually beat Ziggler initially, and the referee realized he kind of messed up. I think Ziggler's foot was on the rope, so the match continued. And you would think that Ziggler would get his win back, but no. In fact, Zack Ryder got the win, a pretty hot finishing sequence to the match. The crowd reacted. It was very cool stuff. Unfortunately, it was the only thing on the show that I could honestly look at and say, man, this was actually really, really good. Where is it going? I don't know. You know, are they going to put the U.S. title on Zack Ryder? I guess we'll find out. But he's one of the few guys right now who's gotten himself over. And, you know, WWE is you know, again, I'm not saying Zack Ryder has to win every single match. Zack Ryder should not go on a Goldberg-like undefeated streak. But it almost seems like this company just doesn't know what they want to do. I mean, a couple of weeks ago on pay-per-view, it was, you know, Ziggler beating Ryder, when really he probably didn't have to. Probably would have made more sense to put the other guy over, but they didn't do that. Now on TV, they put Ryder over him twice in a row on the same show. Where's it going? Who knows? So that brings us to the main event, which was probably the most infuriating thing on the entire show. That was John Cena one-on-one with The Miz, and they went on and on about how it's a WrestleMania rematch, you know, a rematch of their classic bout, yeah, classically crappy bout at WrestleMania 27. I don't know what the big deal is. We've seen John Cena and The Miz at least once on television, if not more than once, have a singles match since WrestleMania, and I'm not counting, you know, obviously they had the match at the next pay-per-view and then Over the Limit. But as far as a Raw TV match, they've had at least one other one on TV. This was not a big deal. So they have a match, and of course, you would think that they're going to do something in this match to help build to the Survivor Series. The Rock has now officially accepted Cena's invitation to be his tag team partner. The Rock does not like John Cena. He made that very clear. He doesn't like John Cena, and he and Cena are on a collision course for WrestleMania 28 in Miami. But Miz and Truth are such a dastardly, dangerous force in WWE that only The Rock, the only thing The Rock can do is set aside his differences with Cena and be his tag team partner so they could rid the WWE universe of Miz and R-Truth at the pay-per-view. So here we have Cena by himself, one-on-one against Miz. They brawl to the outside later in the match. There's a guy in the crowd with a scream mask on. And of course, we could all figure out who that was. And the action spills back into the ring, and Cena just puts Miz in an STF and taps him out, just like that. The Miz taps out like nobody's business. Just could not tap any quicker than he did. And the Scream Mask person runs into the ring to attack John Cena, And Cena just lays him out with an attitude adjustment, takes the mask off, and reveals that it is, in fact, R-Truth. So then Cena puts the mask on. Ha ha! What great comedy that is. And that's it. Cena smiling. He's got that smirk, that trademark Cena smirk on his face. And the show goes off the air. Happy Halloween, everybody. I cannot think of a scarier finish to a Raw show than what they gave us on Monday night. So, let me get this straight. Okay, let's just evaluate here what we have. Because maybe I'm being too harsh. You know, like I said, there were a few people. All right, really, it was only like one person. But there were a few people, I thought, on Facebook who were trying to defend the show and were trying to defend this finish. So let me see. Maybe I'm just being overly critical here. Okay? We have Miz and R-Truth, who WWE, over the last few months, has been trying to make into a big deal. Think back to Hell in a Cell. They did that pretty cool angle at the end of the show where Miz and Truth came into the cage. It was total pandemonium and chaos, and they were beating people up with lead pipes and just beating up cameramen and referees and everybody. And then the cops came, and they had to arrest them, and Triple H went after them. It was a chaotic scene. And they did that YouTube video where they apologized, and you know, Miz and Truth make a pretty good team. They make a pretty good combination. Okay, I will say that much. Now, again, I don't know that I can ever take the Miz as seriously as I'm supposed to be taking him in this angle. You know, this is a serious angle here. And we're supposed to take The Miz to be some sort of badass, and there's just something about him. Truth, I can believe, could be a badass. You know, even with the comedy character, you could believe that this guy is crazy enough, psychotic enough, to be a legitimately dangerous person. To me, Miz, not so much. But, okay, put that aside. I think they've done a pretty good job of building these guys up. They have been a thorn in John Cena's side now for weeks. They've interfered in his matches, you know, cost him championships. John Laurinaitis gives Cena the opportunity to pick any tag team partner he wants at the Survivor Series. And Cena picks The Rock. He picks the same guy that has insulted him and tormented him and helped turn the crowd against him even more, his WrestleMania adversary. And Cena picks him. Okay, I can live with that. Fine. And we have that promo from The Rock at the beginning. I'm not going to team with you. I don't like you. You suck. But Miz and R-Truth, they're such a dangerous, annoying combination that you and I will put our differences together. You know, for the first time ever, last time ever, you and I as partners. And on the very same show, to have one half of that team, to have John Cena by himself, Cena went and got The Rock because he just could not do it on his own. And on this show, he taps out The Miz, which he didn't have to do. He taps out The Miz with the STF. He beats up R-Truth. He leaves them both laying by himself at the end of the show. So my question is, why does he need The Rock? Why team with The Rock? You don't like The Rock. The Rock doesn't like you. You would only do something like that if you absolutely had to. Your back is up against the wall. You have nobody else that you can team with. You want somebody that you know can help you win. But you've now gone and beaten both guys single-handedly. You've left them laying. You've made them look like a bunch of jokes. So why should I care that The Rock and John Cena are going to team at Survivor Series? Why should I care that Miz and R-Truth are in the Survivor Series pay-per-view main event at Madison Square Garden? The only way that Rock and Cena don't win that match at the pay-per-view, and they may well not win that match, is because of bad blood between them, because they can't coexist, because Rock cost Cena the match, or Cena cost Rock the match, either on purpose or by accident. It's not like Miz and Truth have a prayer in the world of legitimately beating The Rock and John Cena. Nobody thought that going into that show on Monday night. Coming out of that show on Monday night, people think even less of that main event at Survivor Series. So I don't understand who thought this was a good idea. I can't imagine that anybody, any one of the actual smart, intelligent people backstage, and believe it or not, there are a few that work for that company, actually thought this was a good idea. How does this build Survivor Series? Explain that to me. There is no explanation for it. There is no possible defense of what they did on Monday night in that main event. And I don't care if, let's say, this week in England, or the week after that when The Rock is on Raw, the go-home show to the pay-per-view, if Miz and Truth try to get their heat back with a big beatdown. I'm sure they will. We've got 2 weeks until Survivor Series. I can't imagine that they're going to beat Miz and R-Truth again next week and then the week after that. I'm sure there's going to be at least one big beatdown of John Cena. Or they'll wait until The Rock comes to Raw, and maybe the go-home show 6 days before Survivor Series will be Miz and R-Truth standing tall over Rock and Cena who are laid out. That's the way, quite frankly, that it should be. But even if they do it that way, it doesn't make any more sense out of what we saw Monday night. I could not be any more angry than I was at the end of that show. Because I'm going to the Survivor Series. I'm looking forward to seeing The Rock's first match in 8 years. That's a very big deal. I'm paying good money to go to the show and see this. And the reason that I have hope, all, you know, it's not like all hope is lost or anything like that with this Rock Cena stuff. I posted a picture on my Twitter a couple of days ago. I was in Times Square on Friday night. And I'm walking along and I look up and you can't avoid it. It's just gigantic. A giant billboard in the middle of Times Square in New York City for WrestleMania 28. It's a very simple ad. It's a picture of John Cena facing The Rock. And it says John Cena, it says The Rock, WrestleMania 28 in Miami. It's really an awesome poster. Very basic, but just awesome. Especially when you're standing in front of it and it's just hundreds of feet tall. I mean, I don't know how big this thing is. You could see this in orbit from space. And I'm standing there and I kind of had a moment looking at this poster and I thought to myself, you know what? No matter what happens between now and WrestleMania, it's going to be okay. Rock versus Cena at WrestleMania 28 is going to be a huge, huge match. I mean, this match is going to be a big deal and it's going to be big business. And no matter what bullshit they feed us between now and then, The Rock isn't going to let things get that bad. And I'm looking at this poster thinking, man, this is really going to be a big match. And Survivor Series is coming up in a couple of weeks, and I don't know what they've got planned, but whatever it is, I'm sure that it will do something to further their feud heading into WrestleMania. But it's the little things like this from one week to the other that just piss me off, because it's basic stuff. You know, Miz and R-Truth could really benefit from working with Cena and working with The Rock. You know, The Miz used to be the WWE champion. This may be a better spot for him to be in. Think about the way he got booked as champion. He was not the strongest champion that WWE has ever seen. In fact, he hardly beat anybody. I think he feuded with Jerry Lawler mostly before he ultimately lost the championship. So even though he's not competing for a title, titles don't mean anything now. I mean, look at Alberto Del Rio. He got knocked out by Big Show. Miz is headlining Survivor Series against The Rock. R-Truth is headlining Survivor Series against The Rock. Think about where R-Truth was a year ago. The guy was a jobber. And now he's headlining Survivor Series against The Rock. This is a very big deal. And you have to be very careful with the way you treat these guys because you want people to believe that these guys have a chance of winning. You want people to believe that, hey, this guy's dangerous. He's out here a couple weeks ago beating people with pipes, getting arrested, handcuffed by the cops. And then he just gets beaten by John Cena. And The Miz gets beaten by John Cena. And we're supposed to care. Oh my God, is The Rock going to accept John Cena's invitation? Well, you know what? After this show, who gives a shit? Who really cares? So this show really aggravated the shit out of me. And it had nothing to do with the Muppets. And it had everything to do with the way this show was booked. It's really all it comes down to. You could have, it doesn't matter who the guest host is. I mean, thank God they're not doing it every week. It's every now and then. Muppets didn't ruin Raw. Raw ruined Raw. It's like when Vince McMahon said Brett screwed Brett. Yeah, well, Vince screwed Vince on this show because this show was no good. And that doesn't even count the Michael Cole, Jim Ross bait and switch that we got on this show. You'll never hear me complain about the fact that we got less Michael Cole, but did we really? I mean, we had to hear Cole all throughout the show continue to insult Jim Ross, and this was supposed to be the week of the Michael Cole Challenge. And they hyped it, and they hyped it. And I guess what ended up happening was the show ran long because of the Muppet stuff. So they knew they weren't going to be able to fit it in. Apparently Jim Ross, everybody knew before they even went on the air that this segment was going to be cut. Whatever they had planned was going to be cut from the show. But we still had to listen to Cole talk about Jim Ross and call him fat. And then, of course, he got up on the announce table and said he had irritable bowel syndrome and all these different things. And he mocked him and he mocked him and he challenged him again to show up in England this week. And I can tell you that as far as I know, Jim Ross is not in England. He is not planning on going to England. So it appears to be a situation for at least another week. Cole is going to pretend that Jim Ross is there and then claim that he isn't, and he'll insult him. Obviously, JR is going to show up one of these weeks, either on The Rock, Raw, maybe Survivor Series, who knows. But still, you promise something, and you don't bother hyping matches anymore. This was essentially, other than the Muppets, one of the only things they promoted for the show this week. And they didn't even deliver it. And it would be one thing if they didn't deliver it and they just completely dropped the idea, which I'd be totally fine with. But no, we're still going to get it. They're just going to drag it out even more. So that sucks. I can tell you what doesn't suck, though. Everything else I'm going to talk about on this show. We've gotten the really bad stuff out of the way. Raw was just awful on Monday night, okay? There's no defense of that show. But SmackDown was a pretty damn good show. And so was Impact, for that matter. And then on Memphis Heat, I'll talk about in a second. Let's talk about SmackDown first. SmackDown started out with a street fight, which for all intents and purposes was should have been the main event on this show. A really good street fight with Randy Orton and Cody Rhodes, but you know, here's the thing. I heard a lot of praise for this match before I watched it. And people were saying, oh my God, you've got to see this Cody Rhodes-Randy Orton match. It's so great and this and that. And I watched the match, and I think that's overdoing it just a bit. You know, it was a good match, don't get me wrong, but by no means was this a great match. These types of matches, they don't really work as well, quite frankly, without blood. It doesn't have to have blood. I'm just saying, the bigger question here is, why are they having a street fight? I mean, I didn't know that Orton and Rhodes had such a heated rivalry going on. I know they've been feuding for a couple of weeks. I know Orton cost, or rather, Cody cost Orton the championship at one point. And, you know, you could have really built something here on the backstory of them. You know, they used to be in Legacy and all this stuff. And I don't know. Maybe I'm wrong. Maybe I haven't been paying close enough attention to the feud. I don't believe at any point Rhodes got a win over Orton. Obviously, at the pay-per-view, Randy beat him clean as a sheet, as he did on this show, with an RKO in the middle of the ring. He gave him a draping DDT on the floor, put him in the ring, gave him an RKO, pinned him 1-2-3. They built it up as being the blow-off, so I guess that's pretty much it. Sucks to be Cody Rhodes in this feud. I don't really know what he gained out of it. He got a couple of headlining matches with Orton, that's about it. Cody's, you know, his star is on the rise. I think big things are in his future, but I don't know that he really benefited much from being in this feud. But, you know, good street fight, nothing great. We saw the debut of Epico on this show, the former Tito Colon and Dos Equis down in FCW. He had been there since the early part of 2010, I believe, down in developmental. He's actually Orlando Colon, the cousin of Carlito and Primo. And he looks to be forming some sort of team or alliance with Junico, the former Sin Cara Negro. So I'm all for new faces. I thought this was fine. It was Epico, by the way, one-on-one, making his debut against the real Sin Cara when the fake Sin Cara interfered. And like I said, it appears some sort of alliance is forming or has formed between the two men. We'll see where it goes. I'm all for new faces, so I can say nothing bad about this. And as far as the rest of the show is concerned, again, pretty good stuff. We saw Big Show came in for a segment where he talked, and Big Show is great in that role. He's just this down-to-earth, likable guy. He's very articulate and well-spoken. When he does a promo, it doesn't sound like he's talking to us. It sounds like he's just being conversational. You know, he's a natural on the microphone. And then Christian came out, and he was scared that Big Show was going to knock him out. And Big Show said, look, I'm not going to knock you out. And he didn't. He kept his word, but he did chokeslam the guy. It was supposed to be a rematch between Sheamus and Christian. Christian said he couldn't compete. Wade Barrett came out. We had a Wade Barrett-Sheamus match. Christian interfered, cost Sheamus the match. Wade Barrett rolled him up, so that feud must continue. We saw Mark Henry and Daniel Bryan, Mr. Money in the Bank, in the main event. And Daniel Bryan has maintained now for months that he is not going to cash in his briefcase until WrestleMania. He's a man of his word, and he is intent on keeping his word. And yet, when this match was over, Big Show, by the way, was at ringside. He knocked out Mark Henry, cost Daniel Bryan the match, and Daniel Bryan was also kind of loopy. He was knocked loopy, and Big Show said, listen, he's knocked out. I knocked him out. You got to cash it in. You got to cash it in right now. Now, granted, Bryan was not exactly 100%. You know, he was, like I said, knocked a little loopy himself. He was not all there, but still, He was about to cash in Money in the Bank. He had no problem handing the briefcase to the referee until Mark Henry grabbed him and dropped him with a World's Strongest Slam. So again, Daniel Bryan, in fact, doesn't really give a shit about cashing in at WrestleMania. If the opportunity were to present itself, he'd cash in a heartbeat. That's what I took away from this. But anyway, this was done to further the Mark Henry-Big Show feud. Mark Henry ended up leaving Big Show laying. He hit him in the head with the briefcase, and they're going to have a match at Survivor Series, and we'll see how that goes. I mean, the last time Survivor Series was in Madison Square Garden in 2002, Big Show was in the championship match there as well. That was the WWE championship match against Brock Lesnar. And I still remember that match today. The match itself, it wasn't very long, but it was a pretty good match. I mean, Brock Lesnar threw Big Show around the ring like nobody's business, gave him the F5. Paul Heyman turned on Lesnar. Big Show won the championship that night. The point to all this is that Big Show was lucky in MSG that night. Will he be as lucky this year in MSG at Survivor Series? I hope not. And the reason I say that is because one of the few things WWE has done a fantastic job of is building Mark Henry up as a monster. And I mentioned before, you look at R-Truth. R-Truth was a jobber. He was a job guy in this company. Low mid-card guy, going nowhere for years. And almost overnight, he turned heel, he showed more charisma and more personality, and really opened a lot of eyes in that company. And part of it also was the lack of depth on the talent roster. So R-Truth was a beneficiary of there just not being that many stars. But now you look at the guy, and despite the way they treated him on Monday night, he's a main event player. He's headlining Survivor Series against The Rock. That's a pretty big deal. Look at Mark Henry, for crying out loud. Mark Henry has been in this company for 15 years. And Mark Henry, for years now, has been nothing more than a glorified job guy. He would come out, he was teaming up with MVP at one point, and then he was doing this, and he was getting beaten every single week. They would call him the world's strongest man, but he would get beaten. And you ask yourself after a while, how tough could this guy be? He's getting beaten up on TV every week. They'd call him the Kool-Aid Man. And then something happened. He got drafted to SmackDown. And I talked about it on the Sound Off. When he got drafted to SmackDown, even though to me, the draft is a joke, but to him it was a big deal. And they did an interview backstage with him for WWE.com. Again, the best stuff airs on the website, not on TV. Anyway, he did this interview where he got all emotional. He was crying. He was legitimately moved. He thought he had been through a lot. He talked about trying to slim down and get himself in shape. When he was talking about that and getting all emotional, I mean, maybe he had some sort of health scare, I don't know. But it was a big deal to him, and he talked about how this may be his last chance. He's going to SmackDown. He's not going to SmackDown to waste time and sit around. He's going to SmackDown to be the man. He's going to SmackDown to become the champion. It took a little bit longer maybe than he would have thought, but that's exactly what happened. I mean, they put him in there in September with Randy Orton. He beat Orton clean. He won the championship, and people were stunned. Go back and watch that crowd reaction at Night of Champions. People could not believe that Mark Henry had beaten Randy Orton the way he did. And then he beat Orton again, and he's been on a roll. And I don't think it's time to take the championship off of him. I really think that you got to keep the momentum going. Do you keep it going until WrestleMania? Maybe. I mean, I don't know that Daniel Bryan, quite frankly, and Mark Henry is going to be as good of a match as Daniel Bryan and Randy Orton would be. I mean, if they kept it going until the Royal Rumble or Elimination Chamber and had Orton finally beat Henry for the title, I'd be okay with that. But I still think it's, you know, Survivor Series, it's November. Mark Henry is still on a roll. SmackDown has been doing really well each week. It's had some of its biggest numbers ever. And I think at least part of that has to be attributed to Mark Henry. I'm not going to give Mark Henry all the credit for that. I think that has something to do with, they bill it as the new fall season and whatever. But the numbers correlate. You know, Mark Henry has been pushed on top as champion, and SmackDown is doing some of its best numbers that it's done since the move to Sci-Fi. I just think it would be a mistake to take the title off him. Big Show does not need to be the champion. Mark Henry, I think, does need to be the champion. Some guys need that as a crutch. And as good as he's doing, I think if you take it off him too soon, you could do more harm than good. So hopefully that does not happen. But I like SmackDown overall. I was really impressed by it. It was nice to get the bad taste out of my mouth from Raw. And then I went back and I watched part of Impact. I did not watch the entire show, but I did go on YouTube. I went on TNA's YouTube channel, or maybe it wasn't their YouTube channel, but I made it a point to watch all of the Bobby Roode James Storm stuff. So the opening promo, the 15-minute promo in the ring with the two of them, I thought was really good. I still think it's kind of funny to have a show where wrestling matters and you start the show with 15 minutes of talking. But in this case, it was okay. They were building a match that, quite frankly, they should have built up over a longer period of time. What the hell are you going to do? This is the cards that you were dealt as a fan, and everything gets rushed. That's just the way it is. That, to me, was a huge mistake, because the main event on this show, which I thought was a good match, again, I didn't think it was a great match, I thought it was a good match. The main event on this show, it just didn't seem like people were all that into it. And on a show where they usually, more often than they should, pipe in fake crowd noise and all this stuff, they probably could have benefited from doing some of that here. If anything, I don't think they pumped enough crowd noise into this match. People just didn't really seem to give a shit up until the end of the match. The end of this match, was really good stuff. You had Bobby Roode was trying. I mean, it was going back and forth, but Bobby Roode was trying everything to beat this guy, his best friend, his tag team partner, and he just couldn't do it. He couldn't beat it. And referee Brian Hebner, I think, got knocked out of the ring. Not knocked out, just knocked to the outside, if I remember correctly. And anyway, he supposedly landed on his knee or his ankle the wrong way. I think he twisted his knee. He was in a great deal of distress. And Bobby Roode had rolled out of the ring, and he's laying out there, and he kind of looks over, and on the steps, on the steel steps, there sits a lone beer bottle. I guess the beer bottle that James Storm had brought to the ring with him. But the way this was shot was excellent. It was excellently done. Excellently executed, as Bret Hart might say. They showed the beer bottle, and they showed Bobby Roode, and they showed the beer bottle, and they showed Bobby Roode, and he looked all conflicted, and he didn't know what to do, and he looked back at the referee to make sure that he wasn't looking, and you know, he made his choice. He decided, all right, enough of this shit. I can't beat this guy. Fuck this. I'm going to grab the beer bottle, and I'm going to smash him in the head with it. And that's exactly what he did. He grabbed the beer bottle. James Storm reached out of the ring to the outside to kind of pull Bobby Roode back in, and Bobby Roode hauled off and smashed the beer bottle right in his head, just right in his skull. Knocked him out, glass shatters everywhere. He gets the referee's attention, brings the referee into the ring, and gets the pinfall. 1, 2, 3, new world champion Bobby Roode. The fans were enraged at the outcome of this match. And again, you go back to that shot of Bobby Roode and the beer bottle on the outside. There's certain shots, camera angles, or whatever that stick out in your mind over time. To me, one of the all-time classic ones is WrestleMania 19, that shot of Vince McMahon at his street fight with Hulk Hogan, the bloodied face of Vince McMahon, the eyes peering over the ring apron as he went to grab a lead pipe as a weapon, you know, just stuff like that. This was one of those shots. It was just, the way it was filmed was just excellently done, and very unlike TNA in a lot of ways. Not that they don't have talented people who work in their production department. I mean, David Sahadi is one of the people who works for them in production, and Sahadi is somebody who did a lot of great work for WWE over the years. In fact, he was responsible for many of their pay-per-view intros for many, many years. He works for TNA now. But it was just excellently done. The finish of this match was great. And Bobby Roode made his decision, turned heel, stood over James Storm, spat on him a couple of times, put his boot on his chest to add insult to injury, and posed with the championship. And after the show, if you go on YouTube, they posted a post-match interview backstage with James Storm, or rather with Bobby Roode and James Storm's reaction. And Bobby Roode did a hell of an interview here. He talked about, you know, James, he did what he had to do, and James Storm was, you know, fat and untalented, and he was the guy that made that tag team, and the Bobby Roode era has begun, and all of this stuff. And then they showed James Storm angrily walking backstage, throwing debris all over the place. And I don't think he suffered a cut on his head, because I didn't see any blood or anything on his head. But his fingers were all cut up, I guess, from the glass or whatever. And he was being treated backstage, and he was a man of few words. He talked about how this blood, you know, soon Bobby Roode would see his own blood or something like that. But beyond that, he didn't really say anything. He told the camera guy to get the hell out of there. And this was just really well done. Really, really well done stuff. It's really too bad that they felt the need to rush this the way they did, because this storyline could have been awesome if you would have built it up over a couple of months. I'm not saying even 6 months, because I know they have ADD, they can't go that long, but even 3 or 4 months, you know. Roode pretends that he's really happy for Storm. They keep tag-teaming at the same time that Storm is defending the championship. They could do some more tag-team matches. And it just builds and it builds, and it kind of builds to a point where you can tell that Bobby Roode is jealous, or getting increasingly jealous at James Storm. It's the same way they did the Triple H Batista storyline back in 2004 into 2005. It wasn't something that happened overnight. It was something that built over the course of a couple of months, and quite frankly, that was something they lucked into, because the original plan then was to have Randy Orton and Triple H at WrestleMania 21. You know, Randy Orton was the chosen son, and Big Dave was just the muscle of Evolution. But Big Dave had this charisma that Orton didn't have. Still does, in my opinion. And there were certain things that would be done, and Batista would make a certain facial expression. Or I remember there was one episode of Raw where I think it was something where Batista and Triple H each had a match, and they had some sort of bet or who can win their match fastest, or something like that. And Batista won, and he confronted Triple H and Ric Flair backstage and said, "I want my money." And he did it in, like, he deadpanned it. Like, he was totally serious when he said it, and Triple H couldn't believe it. And Triple H goes to Ric Flair, give him his money. And Batista says to Flair, "I don't want you to give me your money. I want your money. I won the bet. I want my money." And the punchline to the whole segment was, you know, Triple H, who was, I think, a mixture of both angry and shocked and afraid, went to give Batista money, and Batista just started laughing and said, "I was just playing with you, man," and he walked off. I remember that. It was little things like that that made that storyline so fucking fantastic, and I feel like they could have done something similar here, where even if people see it coming from a mile away, the Batista thing, people could see that coming from a mile away. Batista won the Royal Rumble, and there was no question in anyone's mind which title Batista was gonna compete for at WrestleMania. You know, he had the choice of either the WWE title or the World Heavyweight title. And they had that one episode of Raw where Batista had two contracts. Which one was he going to sign? Of course he picked Raw, and he attacked Triple H and powerbombed him through the table, and the place went nuts. That WrestleMania with Batista and Triple H as the main event back in 2005 did some of the biggest business that WrestleMania has done in the last 10 or 12 years. It did huge business. It did over 1 million buys that show on the back of that main event. For a storyline that was pretty predictable. If you really stop and think about it, there were no swerves, there were no big surprises. The only real surprise was that it was Batista instead of Randy Orton who ended up going to WrestleMania and winning the title. So in this case, you could have done something very similar. Even if, you know, Bobby Roode is making certain facial expressions or some of the things that he's saying, it's obvious where they're going with the storyline. Who cares? That's the way that you do it. That would have been the perfect way to build heat between these two guys. And they didn't do it that way, unfortunately. You know, and both guys had their crowning moments in throwaway, you know, matches on Impact that people probably won't remember a year from now. But at the end of the day, you can't change what they did. You can only try to enjoy it for what it is. And for at least 1 week, I can honestly say that Impact, and I didn't even see the whole show, but I can say that Impact and what I saw on Impact from their main storyline, at least, was far and away better than anything I saw on Raw this past Monday night. And we'll see if that pattern continues, but for 1 week anyway, thumbs up TNA. I thought that this was just really well done.
It's Noah Mark, and I would like to congratulate the Sala Monster on 4 years of the Sound Off. You know, the Sound Off is really just a cheap version of SC Scoops Live without the greatest co-host in the world, Noah Mark. And why they don't have me on the Sound Off? Well, it's budgetary reasons. They can't afford me. I'm very expensive. Let's just be honest. So I'd love to be a part of the Sound Off if maybe they can get their budget in order. I don't think that'll ever happen. But congratulations there, Slobber Monster. You are the best. Not since Katie Vick has there been a stupider idea to have you on each and every week doing the Sound Off. So you go ahead and give us your Survivor Series predictions, and when they all turn out to be false, I'll be sitting right next to you live at the Survivor Series telling you, "Told you so." Take care.
Remind me to kick his ass when I see him in a couple of weeks, all right? Do me that favor, will you? Memphis Heat. Let's talk a little bit about this awesome documentary. I finally got a chance to sit down and watch it. It's about 90 minutes in length, and it was great. Everything that everybody's been saying about it has been pretty much right on the money. It was just a really enjoyable trip down memory lane for somebody, in my case, who I didn't grow up in Memphis or the Midwest or anything like that. So, you know, I didn't grow up a fan of Memphis wrestling or any of that. But as a fan of wrestling history, and as somebody who finds himself becoming more and more nostalgic over time as the current product continues to just depress me and infuriate me even more, I find myself watching old wrestling, whether it be WWE, NWA, WCW, and in this case, the Memphis stuff, and I just find myself completely you know, fascinated by what I'm watching and just happy again, quite frankly. And it was a great trip down memory lane. It focused on a couple of different personalities. You know, there's lots of comments on here from Jerry Lawler, footage from his early days, including his own music video, which I never even knew existed. The empty arena match from Memphis with Terry Funk, and his famous feud with Andy Kaufman, who I was not aware of this, but apparently Andy Kaufman had reached out to the WWWF and Vince McMahon Sr. back in the day to see if they might be interested in doing anything with a celebrity. And they turned him down, and that's why Kaufman ended up doing something with Jerry Lawler in Memphis. We had a lot of stuff on here about Sputnik Monroe, who I was not all that familiar with Sputnik Monroe. And Rocky Johnson, who was also interviewed on this documentary, referred to Sputnik as, quote, a black man living in a white man's body. He Sputnik just comes across as a really nice guy who helped break barriers in the territory as far as, the African-American fans are concerned and sticking up for them and trying to do what was right. And there wasn't anybody interviewed on this DVD that really had a bad word to say about Sputnik Monroe. So if that's a name that you are not familiar with, you are not alone. I mean, I was familiar with the name, but I didn't know too much about the guy. But when you watch this, it's going to be very hard not to like him and go on Wikipedia or whatever and try to do your research and find out more about the guy. He seems like a class act. Jimmy Valiant is featured a lot on here as well, as is Jackie Fargo, who has an opposite to Sputnik Monroe, at least maybe to me. Jackie Fargo just comes across like an arrogant asshole to me on this DVD. I know Jerry Lawler has always talked about how Jackie Fargo was always his favorite, and he was Jerry Lawler's idol when Lawler was first breaking into the business. And that's all well and good. I'm not saying Jackie Fargo wasn't a talented performer, but at least on this DVD, he came across like an arrogant prick. The documentary, if I had one bad thing to say about it, it's the fact that it just seemed to end kind of abruptly. They covered a lot of the early stuff. They also covered a lot of stuff with respect to Jimmy Hart. Jimmy Hart was probably up there with Jerry Lawler as being like the most featured performer on this documentary. But when they get through the Jimmy Hart stuff and the Jerry Lawler, Andy Kaufman stuff, and you get to like that 1984-85 period, it just, they kind of fast forward to what happened in 2001 and what happened here and what happened there, and then they go to the credits and that's it. And there's so much stuff that they could have covered in here. And I know it was only 90 minutes. If you really wanted to cover all the stuff from the history of Memphis, you're talking about several hours worth. But I feel like even if they just touched on different periods from 85 on to like 2001, they could have covered so much more. So if anything disappointed me, it was the fact that there wasn't enough about Memphis here at the end. But it's hardly a major criticism, I think, to levy at the movie. It was still really great stuff. Like I said, Jimmy Hart was another featured performer here, and he's seemingly a timeless individual. I mean, he looks virtually the same as he did 40 years ago. A couple of other observations really quick here. The Memphis Tape Library, aside from the Bill Watts UWF footage, I think is the only big one not under Vince McMahon's control. So it was really nice to see the footage here on this DVD. It wasn't all great quality. I mean, again, you're talking about footage that has not been remastered or restored by WWE, and footage that is in some cases 30, 40 years old. There's some tracking issues in certain cases, but at no point was it difficult to watch or anything like that. It was actually kind of nice, to be honest. It felt like I was watching the old vintage footage as it was intended to be watched. But again, to see a library like Memphis, there were so many big stars who came through Memphis. There's clips of Hulk Hogan when he came through Memphis, Ric Flair, Randy Savage. Vince McMahon is on this DVD as well, from when he was doing that angle in Memphis where he was the heel. And WWE doesn't own that footage, so he was on here as well. So it was just really, really cool to see. And like I said, aside from the Bill Watts UWF footage, I don't think there's any other tape library out there of any great significance from this country. I'm not counting Japan or anything like that, that Vince McMahon doesn't have control of. So it was kind of unique and kind of fun to watch. The other thing also is you learn a lot about Lance Russell. If you're not familiar with Lance Russell's work, Lance Russell was the, in many ways, the Jim Ross of Memphis. In terms of Jim Ross now is looked at as some sort of great historic figure, one of the greatest, if not the greatest, play-by-play broadcaster in the history of the business. Lance Russell, for that territory, for that period, for many, many years, was the man. And he was a natural. In fact, when they were showing footage of the empty arena match with Terry Funk and Jerry Lawler, before Lawler came out, Terry Funk's in the ring, and he's cursing up a storm, complaining, "Where's Jerry Lawler? Where's Jerry Lawler?" And he's dropping S-bombs and all this stuff. And Lance Russell's on the outside with the mic. I think Lance was the only other person in the building besides Funk and Lawler and the camera guy, I guess. And Lance Russell's like, "Would you please stop cussing? We're not going to be able to use any of this if you don't stop." Just, I don't know, his whole demeanor. He was just a really talented individual, very good at his job. And it's too bad he never really had a chance to break through and be a big face on the national level, because he could have been up there with somebody like a Jim Ross. But The thing about Lance Russell that really angered me here was it made me remember the story I had heard heading into the WWE Hall of Fame back in 2007. That was the year that Jerry Lawler went into the Hall of Fame. And Jerry Lawler wanted Lance Russell to induct him into the Hall of Fame to do his induction speech. Because Russell was really the person who helped give Lawler his big break in the wrestling business. Lawler was... and still is very talented in terms of the artwork that he does and all of that, and I think it was Russell that took notice of it and gave him his first foot in the door. And Lance Russell was there for a majority of Jerry Lawler's career. When Lawler ascended and became the big star that he became, Russell was there every step of the way, calling his matches, doing the interviews. There really would not have been a better person to do that induction than Lance Russell. And it was Kevin Dunn who put the kibosh on that and rejected Jerry Lawler's request. Because in his words, nobody would know who Lance Russell is. He's not well known to our audience. Instead, they went with William Shatner to do the induction for Jerry Lawler. Why? Because Shatner did one fucking segment with Lawler on Raw back in 1994. He gave him a monkey flip on the King's Court. So therefore, that makes him worthy enough of inducting Lawler into the Hall of Fame. I mean, if that isn't a microcosm of how ass backwards this company can be, more often than not, I don't know what is. And for whatever reason, it really made me very angry just to think back to that, because I remember when I heard that story back in 07, I said, man, that's pretty stupid. But to be honest with you, my familiarity with Lance Russell was very limited, and still is. But I learned a lot about the guy after watching this documentary, and it made me even more angry that of all the excuses to give, that's the excuse, because nobody's going to know who he is. Give me a break. Anyway, the level of hypocrisy here with Jerry Jarrett as well was quite apparent. You know, Jerry Jarrett is also prominently featured on this DVD. Of course, he's talked about as being this wonderful booker and this and that, and he was very successful. Not always, but you watch this documentary, you would think that he was the best booker that ever lived. But at one point, he's talking about Nick Gulas, who is another promoter. And there's a lot of interesting discussion on here as well about the between promoters and stuff as well that I think you might find interesting. And one of the stories here, Jerry Jarrett was talking about how Nick Gulas wanted Jerry Jarrett to start pushing his son, George Gulas, very hard. And Jerry did not want to do that. Jerry thought that George was not deserving of it. It's just the dad wanting to push his untalented son. And Nick was insistent upon it and said that he would get rid of Jerry. Jerry ended up quitting over the whole thing. And yet, of course, Jerry would later push his own son very hard. Although, in fairness, I'm sure Jeff Jarrett is and was a much, much better wrestler than George Gulas ever was, based on all accounts of his work. But even so, just the notion itself, I don't even know if that came across to Jerry Jarrett as he was saying this on the DVD, but, you know. The father is always going to look to push his son. I mean, look no further than Eric and Garrett Bischoff on Impact right now. Or back in the day, Vern Gagne and Greg Gagne, you know, the Von Erichs, although they had a lot of luck, I will say that much. You know, Fritz Von Erich certainly had a lot of success pushing his sons down in world class. That did work out pretty well for them. Well, depends on your definition of working out pretty well, since most of them are now dead. But I just thought that was kind of hypocritical for Jerry Jarrett to talk about how, oh, you know, I refused and I stood my ground. I'm not going to push your son and this and that. And yet that's exactly what Jerry Jarrett would do with his own son many years later. So anyway, that aside, this was a great documentary. I would highly recommend it to anybody. If you're not familiar with Memphis or you're really young and all you know is WWE and TNA and you think this will be boring to you, honestly, if you're a person like that, I could see where maybe the very beginning of this might be boring to you. I wasn't bored just because I was fascinated by the whole thing. But it really picks up and it really gets good. Once they get into the Jerry Lawler stuff, it really picks up from there. I think this is something that anybody listening to the show right now will enjoy. Maybe some a little bit more than others, but you're not going to watch this or buy this and come away from it thinking you were ripped off or it was a waste of time. So if you're a real wrestling fan, watch this documentary. I will say this, though. I will caution you that if you watch this, there's a pretty good chance that when it's over, it's going to make you more depressed than anything else to see another era of wrestling gone by that we can never, ever have again. And even Jerry Jarrett says that on the DVD. He says, look, the territories would have died out with or without Vince McMahon. Without Vince McMahon, it would have taken a little bit longer. But with the proliferation of the internet and cable television, it was going to die out no matter what. It was not going to be able to sustain itself. And you look back on the success that the Memphis territory had, and Memphis was hardly the only place. I mean, I just mentioned Texas, you know, world class down during the Von Erich days, or Stampede up in Canada. You had all these different places, and down in Florida was always a very popular place for wrestling, and Eddie Graham, I think, ran his territory down there. It's just another era of wrestling that worked very well, and a lot of stars were made, and there were a lot of great matches and great angles and great events and all that, but we can never, ever get that back. And the current era of wrestling is what it is. It could be a lot better than it is, but the fact that it isn't is very aggravating and I think very frustrating. And I watched this DVD and I came away from it thinking, God damn, wrestling was so much better back then than it is now. I love wrestling. I think I'm always going to watch it. I still have a desire. It gets me, you know, excited, even through the bad stuff. But in all honesty, honest to God, wrestling sucks now compared to the way it used to be. And this DVD really made that point very, very apparent. So I will caution you that you may come away from this DVD thinking the same thing. But aside from that, great stuff. And I would highly recommend it. All right, before we get to the mailbag here, I just want to mention one more time for those of you who have not already done so. I've gotten a whole bunch of reviews on iTunes. Solomonster Sounds Off is, in fact, in iTunes. And you can leave a review. Last week, I gave a whole bunch of shout-outs. There was one in particular that I forgot. I wanted to give a shout-out here to Ian Herbert, who also left a review. If you have not already done so, please go on there. You can rate the show, I think, out of 5 stars, and you can leave a review. If you do so, email me or Facebook me and let me know, and I will give you a shout-out on the Sound Off. All you got to do is review the show in iTunes. It's very simple. So go ahead and do that if you haven't already done so. Also, another quick note here. Warriors of Wrestling, having another show here in Brooklyn, New York, 227 4th Avenue. Their next show coming up next Saturday, November 12th. I mention this because their special guest will be Tommy Dreamer. He'll be part of the show. So that's Warriors of Wrestling. Check that out November 12th. Tommy Dreamer will be their special guest. That should be a good time. Let's get into the mailbag right now. Your questions, you can always email me at thesolomonster@gmail.com. thesolomonster@gmail.com. Not to be confused with secscoops@gmail.com. That's the email address for the main page mailbag. A new one, by the way, went up on Friday. So if you missed that, go back and check that one out. First letter comes from Dave. He's been a huge fan of the show since episode 144. First things first, his 21st birthday, taking place in 3 weeks on the 11th of November. That would be Veterans Day here in the U.S. Can I get a shout-out on the Sound Off? Sure. Happy birthday, Dave. His question here, if I could rewrite one major storyline in the last 15 years, what would it be and what would I change about it? Obviously, I think the storyline would have to be the Invasion storyline from 2001. That thing had money written all over it. And as a fan, even if you didn't pay attention to money and ratings and all that sort of stuff and just wanted to sit back and enjoy it for what it is, that whole Invasion was a wet dream for any wrestling fan. I mean, you talk about putting fantasy matches together, some sort of dream card. I get these emails all the time from people. If you could put together your wrestling dream card, you know, what would it be? And I don't even really answer all of them because I'm not even sure how to answer that. I mean, I could go on all day if I wanted to put fantasy matches together. I don't sit here doing fantasy warfare. But back then, that's what the Invasion storyline was all about. That was our real opportunity for us as fans, reality, it could have been, to have real fantasy matches between the biggest and best stars from WWF and the biggest and best stars from WCW. And we got some of that, but a lot of that was botched. And I know some of you disagree. You can disagree all you want to. That storyline, wherever you fall on the spectrum, if you enjoyed it, if you hated it, I guarantee that it did not live up to expectations. It could have been a lot better than it was. That one storyline could very well have changed the course of wrestling as we know it. Not just because of the matches, but because if WCW could have stayed healthy as a brand. I mean, obviously it wasn't healthy. It went out of business, but with the WWE machine behind it, it could have been something again. And the original plan was to run WCW as a separate entity. And we all know what happened in that Tacoma match in Washington with Booker T and Buff Bagwell, and all those plans went to hell. But imagine if it didn't. Imagine if Booker T and Buff Bagwell wasn't the main event on Raw that night. How things might have been different. And had they eaten those contracts and paid the money to bring some of the big stars. I'm not saying they should have taken $30 million and thrown it at everybody and brought Hogan and Flair and Goldberg and Sting and everybody in all at once. But they could have eaten some of that, you know, those guaranteed contracts that people were perfectly content with sitting at home and collecting money on. If Vince McMahon had said, all right, I'm going to pick three big stars, the three big stars from WCW that I think can make us the most money, and I'm going to buy them out of their contracts and bring them over, and Eric Bischoff as well, it really could have meant something. It could have been so much bigger than it was. Instead of waiting and bringing Hogan, Hall, and Nash in, you know, 9 months later, or not even 9 months, almost a year later. Eric Bischoff came later on. Flair came later on. Flair came first, actually, before even they did. He came in November of 01, but by then it was too late. By then the storyline had officially ended because Team WWF had already won its Survivor Series. So that's the storyline I would have changed. There's a lot of things I would have done, like I just mentioned, and even more. I'm not going to get into all that, but that's the one storyline that really, I think, could have been a game changer in wrestling. And instead, it was good for one pay-per-view buy rate, and that was pretty much it. Jake writes in two questions. First, he wanted to know if I saw the ESPN special on Scott Hall. What were my thoughts on that? I did see it. I did review it on the Sound Off a couple of weeks ago. So if you missed it, go back and listen. I talked in depth about it. Basically, it was a very well-done piece that was very sad and depressing because you see what Scott Hall was, what he could have been, and instead what he has become. And even since that special aired, the story only gets more sad because him and his son, who appeared to be enjoying something of a good relationship when that special was filmed, are no longer on speaking terms. So I just thought the whole thing was very sad. The second question here, TNA's Bound for Glory had some sort of agreement with AMC Theaters where the pay-per-view was at movie theaters. Do you think WWE should do something similar in a way where they make it easier for some people to buy and watch the shows? Because when you look at it, they promote it right, they can get a group of three or four people to go and watch the show at a theater where they can only get one buy per household. Doesn't work that way, my friend. In fact, UFC has tried this. UFC has put some pay-per-views in movie theaters, and it has not done well. And think about that. UFC is the king of pay-per-view right now. Aside from whenever Floyd Mayweather or Manny Pacquiao fight, UFC is the dominant brand in terms of pay-per-view. They continuously kick WWE's ass. And if UFC can't turn a profit and do business by putting their shows in movie theaters, believe you me, WWE is not doing any business either, and neither did TNA. I mean, it was actually kind of pathetic. I think the figures were something like 2,000 people across the entire country for all the states that they did this in. A total of 2,000 people, I think, actually went to these theaters to see the show. So, in theory, it's a nice idea. I think WWE has tried it before. They have tried it before. It doesn't work. You can't get enough people to go. You don't make any money off of it. It's just not something that works. Mike from Jeffersonville, Kentucky writes in, will The Rock stay around after WrestleMania? If not, I hope John Cena wins. Why is The Rock doing it? He doesn't need the money. What about the rest of the guys that bust their ass all year? So fuck The Rock. That's right, he said fuck The Rock. Well, The Rock would probably look at you and say fuck you, because the reality is The Rock can do whatever he wants. And to me, the product is much better when he's around. So it's not a matter of fuck The Rock, it's thank God for The Rock. And you talk about the fact that, well, The Rock doesn't need the money, so why does he do it? The Rock does it because he loves wrestling. He doesn't have to be wrestling year-round to love it. He loves it because it's always been in his blood. He became a star in wrestling. His father wrestled. His grandfather wrestled. He genuinely enjoys it. He's very good at it. He enjoys working with a lot of the people who work in the company. Him and Vince McMahon have a relationship going back many years. He hasn't forgotten his wrestling roots. He's coming back to embrace them. He's coming back to make WWE a shitload of money. I'm standing in the middle of Times Square the other day looking at this billboard for WrestleMania thinking to myself, this company is going to make a shitload of money off The Rock. And by the way, The Rock being on WrestleMania, you say, well, what about the other guys who are in the company busting their ass year-round? Those guys on the WrestleMania card stand to make a lot more money because of The Rock. So if they know what's good for them, their attitude won't be your attitude. Their attitude will be, wow, I can't wait for The Rock to wrestle John Cena at WrestleMania. Because however many millions The Rock is going to make off that pay-per-view, it's going to trickle down to everybody else as well. I mean, they should do not only over a million buys, which is what they did this year, they should even top what WrestleMania did this year for next year's show. And everybody benefits. It affects the WWE throughout the rest of the year. How WrestleMania goes, so goes the WWE year. And the reason that they're not having as bad of a year as they're having, and their business is suffering in a lot of different respects, they would be doing a lot worse in terms of their financials right now if The Rock was not part of WrestleMania this year. Jacob from Waynesboro, Tennessee writes in, I was just wondering what happened to Dolph Ziggler's short brown hair. I saw it for about 2 or 3 weeks, but then it went straight back to bleach blonde. Would you please tell me what happened? I'm also part of the Fortune, he calls it the Fortune Four. It's the Fantastic Four, to be exact. He's been listening since episode 179. Well, what happened is WWE wanted to do to him what they do to everybody else. They wanted to do to Dolph what they've basically done to almost, not everybody, but almost everybody in developmental. They want everybody to look the same. Everybody has to look exactly the same. Their haircut has to be exactly the same, so nobody stands out. So they took Dolph's look. He had kind of a unique look, bleach blonde hair, and they gave him the brown hair, and they cut his hair short. They gave him like a crew cut, and he hated it. I mean, you could tell when he came out he didn't like it. He looked just like everybody else. In fact, he came out that first time. I remember that. He looked like Ted DiBiase. I could have sworn it was DiBiase that came out to the ring. So it lasted a couple of weeks, and then they realized, wow, we fucked up. And they let him go back to doing his hair the way he was doing it before. So hopefully you would think that would be a lesson to WWE not to meddle in people's looks. Let them have the haircut they want to have or the hair color they want to have. But nope, they have to have control over everything, every aspect of everybody's life who works for their company. And in this case, it didn't work out. They relented and they let him go back to doing it the way that he wanted to. Got a letter here from Rory Bennett. Has a couple of quick questions. Number one, do you think we'll ever see a referee in the WWE Hall of Fame? One in particular is Charles Robinson. He has a history in the Four Horsemen and Ric Flair at WCW. He and Rick wrestled a tag team match against Randy Savage and Medusa. Nowadays, he spends his days as a referee and a crew member taking up and down the rings. Charles Robinson is a very experienced referee, very good at his job. But I would not put him in the Hall of Fame ahead of people, for example, like Tommy Young, certainly Earl Hebner. You know, those are referees that refereed some of the biggest matches and the biggest championship matches in the NWA and WWF. And I just don't see Charles Robinson being on their level. And I think if you're going to put referees in the Hall of Fame, which I think you should, I think referees, broadcasters, promoters, you know, divas, everybody deserves a shot at being in the Hall of Fame. If you put celebrities in the Hall of Fame, you could put referees in the Hall of Fame. And but I wouldn't put somebody like Charles Robinson in there, or even Nick Patrick or anybody like that, ahead of people like Tommy Young and Earl Hebner, who to me are far more deserving of being acknowledged before they are. Second question here from him. I believe Vicky Guerrero will one day take her place in the Hall of Fame as being one of the greatest managers. She's a heat magnet every time she speaks. Do you agree with me? Well, she is a heat magnet. I don't think she's nearly as quote, hot as she used to be in terms of being a heat magnet. I think her time on SmackDown and her time with Edge and that whole storyline, the people reacted to her. It just felt like they reacted more, which is not to say that she doesn't get a reaction now. I just think she's lost a little bit since she's come over to Raw. She's very good at what she does. She's improved. She's still not... You know, for what she does, she's very, very good. Don't ever confuse her with being great the way somebody like a Jimmy Hart or a Bobby Heenan would be great as a manager. I'll give Vicky all the credit in the world, but I will never, ever confuse her with some of the best managers in wrestling history. Does she deserve to be in the Hall of Fame? No, she doesn't deserve to be in the Hall of Fame. Ask me that question in 5 years, you know, and maybe I'll have a different opinion, but let's not get carried away here. And last question. Rory says that he first wrote in about his hate towards Scott Armstrong's refereeing. He said that I said I didn't pay attention to that, and I made a reference to another referee. I believe that referee was Nick Patrick. Anyway, Rory says, I was just wondering if you now notice his pauses in pinfalls. I do. I do notice his pauses in pinfalls, and it doesn't bother me at all. To me, it's just not a big deal. This question comes from Mike. Do I think the reason WWE has sucked so much of late might be because Vince McMahon is taking all the best ideas and using them in his movies? It's possible that they might be good ideas for Raw, but bad movie ideas. Are you on something right now? Perhaps some sort of medication that offers some pretty potent side effects? That's the only possible explanation I could have for that. Really, the best ideas are in the WWE films releases? Can you pick one of the WWE movies where there's actually a good idea? I know some of them have some good action, some good explosions, but I have not seen all of them, I will admit that, but I know the plots of these movies. For example, I know a lot about John Cena's new movie, The Reunion, without having watched it, although I do have it in my queue. Somebody did send me a link to watch this movie. I have not done so yet. But really? The best ideas are in the WWE films? You can say that with a straight face, because I would disagree with you on that. Lude writes in, he says, on your Facebook page, you expressed some disdain towards the ending of last Monday's Raw, where John Cena single-handedly took out Miz and R-Truth. I've seen a rising number of fans take this stance. Personally, I can't understand this kind of rationality. When I first started watching wrestling, there was no reason for me to believe that Hulk Hogan or the Ultimate Warrior could be beaten by any two other wrestlers. For instance, I remember Hulk Hogan taking out the Natural Disasters all by himself. In comparison, there's no reason to believe that Jet Li, Walker Texas Ranger, Jackie Chan, or the Red Ranger could be taken down by two guys. But we enjoy the action anyway. Why is John Cena different? Even, why is Randy Orton different than other mega action stars? What is the problem? And I love this rationality here. I just love it, you know? So the way things used to be, when you had the Ultimate Warrior and you had Hulk Hogan, who would beat up everybody and would rarely lose matches, what makes that different than the way things are today? Well, first of all, the reason that that worked, and I can tell you that that would not have worked at all if wrestling was then as it is today, is because there's so many more shows. Okay, you have to take that into account, in fairness to everybody. Okay, Raw every week, people go into that show thinking, this has to be a great show. And when Raw isn't great, and they don't hit a home run every single week, people rag on the show. And sometimes Raw gets a bad rap. This week, to me, was not one of those weeks. Raw deserved all the criticism it got this week. And there's been a lot of very bad shows lately. But to go to your point, Hulk Hogan and the Ultimate Warrior were not on television every week back in the day. It was very, very rare that you would see them even on the syndicated shows, like Superstars and Wrestling Challenge, okay? You rarely saw them on television, in fact. And when you did, it was usually a big deal. It was a promo, it was some sort of angle where they were attacked, or maybe it was a match. But they weren't overexposed on television the way that people like John Cena and Randy Orton are overexposed on TV every week. That's part of why Cena takes a lot of flack. He's on the show every fucking week because they're so terrified not to put him on TV because they're so worried that ratings will go down. So John Cena has to be on every show every single week, and his shtick just is grating on the nerves. Whether he comes out, he does the stupid smirk, he does this, he does that. So this is every single week. It's not a situation where we get to see John Cena two or three times a month on TV. Far from it. Same goes for Randy Orton. In fact, now with this whole Raw Super Show shit, we have to see Randy Orton on Raw and SmackDown every single week. And I don't find Randy Orton to be as bad at this point as John Cena. John Cena takes the cake, but a lot of that has to do with the way he's booked. Now, to go to your point, I cannot recall. I'll use this as an example, since you brought up Hulk Hogan from back in the 80s, okay? I'll use this as an example. SummerSlam 1989. They were building to a tag team main event. It was going to be Hulk Hogan and Brutus the Barber Beefcake against the Macho King Randy Savage and Zeus. Okay, Zeus was the character from the No Holds Barred movie that Hogan had filmed, and they brought him in. He was an actor. He was Debo. Okay, everybody knows Debo. So they brought Debo in as Zeus. And they built Zeus up as this unstoppable monster. They did a tremendous job. I mean, Zeus used to really freak me out when I was younger, in part because he just looked weird. He had that one eyeball that just wasn't quite right. He couldn't speak English. He used to just spit and snort. And he just had a really badass look to him. But anyway, the point is, they did everything in their power to protect these guys heading into the pay-per-view. In fact, I remember on a Saturday night's main event, which would have been before the pay-per-view, I think it was in July. So I can't recall if there was any interaction right before the pay-per-view between these four guys. But again, wrestling back then wasn't the way it was now. You didn't have a go-home show before SummerSlam where all four guys would be in some sort of match against each other. What I remember is that on that Saturday night's main event, if I remember correctly, there was a singles match between Macho King and Brutus Beefcake. And I don't remember who won the match or what the outcome was. I think Zeus interfered, so it was probably a disqualification. And I think Zeus was choking the life out of Beefcake. Hogan came in. I think he hit Zeus with a chair from behind, and he probably hit him multiple times before Zeus finally dropped Beefcake. And again, I'm pretty sure this was the month before the pay-per-view. Maybe my timeline is screwed up, but I don't think it is. And they just made Zeus look like such a monster. Like, even the great Hulk Hogan questioned whether or not he could take this guy out. And the point is, they did everything right heading into that match. They made Savage look strong. They made Zeus look strong. Hogan and Beefcake didn't have to look strong. They already did. Beefcake was getting a huge rub by being associated with Hogan. And they went into the pay-per-view, and it was a pretty evenly matched match in terms of you had Hogan and Beefcake, and you had Zeus and Savage, all of which had been made to look strong heading into the pay-per-view. Ultimately, Hogan and Beefcake won, as Hogan usually did back then. But that's how you do it. You didn't have a TV show 6 days before SummerSlam where Hulk Hogan went one-on-one with Randy Savage, beat him in 5 minutes with a leg drop, and then body slammed Zeus and left him laying to end the show. That would be a pretty fucking stupid way to end Raw heading into SummerSlam. That's not the sort of thing they did back then. So pretend that it's 2011 now, right? Okay, pretend that it's Zeus and Savage against Hogan and Beefcake at Survivor Series. And imagine if they had done that on Raw Monday night. If they had Hogan, or they had Beefcake for that matter, beat Savage with ease, and then leave Zeus laying. Who in their right mind would give a shit about SummerSlam? Who would order that pay-per-view caring at all about the main event, or thinking that Savage and Zeus would have any shot at all of winning that match? Nobody would. But that's just not the sort of thing they did back then. But that's common sense. It's not the old school 1989 attitude. That's pro wrestling 101 right there. Simple stuff. John from Maryland writes, and he says, Salamaster, I just don't get it. I have this acquaintance from high school. We both love wrestling. Problem is, I like WWE and respect to some extent TNA. Well, he is all about TNA. I've never met anyone who is a diehard TNA fan before. It's so bad that I ran into him the other day. And he tells me all the great things TNA is doing and how the product is so much better than WWE. I started to wonder, am I watching the same TNA that he does? Because I really can't stand it. I don't watch it because I feel like they are just completely lost when it comes to booking and don't know how to use talent that they have. During this conversation with him, I just wanted to shake him to get some sense into him. But maybe I'm way off base here. I know how you feel about TNA, but just wondering your thoughts on diehard TNA fans. I like to compare diehard TNA fans to diehard ECW fans. They don't know what they like, and they don't know crap when they see it. Maybe I can get a shout-out from my friend as well. His name is Tommy. He listens every week. So there you go. There's a shout-out to Tommy. I think I once compared TNA fans, hardcore TNA fans, to abuse victims. That would be my analogy. But to be honest with you, especially watching Impact, the end of Impact anyway, from Thursday, your friend may have a point. TNA may be, maybe, turning a corner here. And, you know, so he may not be all that off base anymore in terms of what they're doing, perhaps is better than what WWE is doing. At least as of this week, I'd have to give TNA the win over WWE. Now, 1 week, of course, doesn't really mean much. Let's see if they can keep it up. But your friend may not be as off base as you think he is. Natasha writes in, she just wants to ask a question regarding Jeff Hardy. When I was growing up, I wasn't your average girl, she says. I live for wrestling and football in a family full of conservative Catholics. I'm covered in tattoos with a loud, opinionated mouth. I was a super fan of Jeff Hardy because he made being an outsider acceptable. Now, in recent years, he's disappointed me, and now that I'm an adult with children, he's on the no-watch list. But every now and then, I'll be on YouTube and I'll watch his old matches from his glory days, my naive and hoping that he will eventually straighten himself out and give us one more great run. Also, as a female, I have to ask, do you think the Divas division is at this point beyond repair? It makes me sick to see the Divas of today compared to the women of 15 years ago. As far as Jeff Hardy is concerned, I don't think you're being naive at all. I mean, it is possible he could turn his life around. There's people right now in TNA who think that he's turned his life around. And he's been back for a little while, and so far so good. But you look at his track record, and you just know that at some point he's going to fuck up. I mean, I'm not rooting for the guy to fuck up, but I'm just saying, based on his track record, the chances are that something will happen at some point. But is it possible? Sure, it's possible. If he can get his shit together, he's still young enough. He's not as young as he used to be. His body, he probably has the body of somebody a lot older. But it's possible he can have one more great run in him. That's going to be up to Jeff Hardy. It's not going to be up to TNA or anybody else but Jeff Hardy. And as far as the Divas are concerned, I won't say they're past the point of no return or the point of repair. I have said before that if WWE is not going to let them do what they do and give them more than 2 minutes of TV time every week, you may as well just disband the entire division. But the division itself can be salvaged. I mean, let us not forget that when Karma came in, there was a lot of optimism about the Divas division. I was very excited. I was actually interested in the Divas division for the first time maybe since Mickie James did her crazy psycho angle with Trish Stratus back in 2006. That's still the only women's match at a WrestleMania that I've ever looked forward to. So to say that they can't repair it, it can never be what it once was, is wrong. It could be. It's up to WWE to give them the opportunity to be good again, to give the women more than 2 or 3 minutes of television time and put together the same matches every single week that nobody cares about, make people care about the division. You know, eventually they're going to get karma back, probably in a couple of months, maybe early next year. She could be the difference maker. It's going to take more than just her. Her alone is not going to make the Divas Division. But if she comes back and gets some momentum again, and they bring in one or two other women who actually know how to work, I mean, why they haven't given a chance to somebody like a Sara Del Rey, I'll never know. But imagine if karma came in, then somebody like Sara Del Rey, maybe one other female down in FCW that at least knows how to work. That's all you need. Freshen things up a little bit, put women in there that actually know how to perform, as opposed to people like Rosa Mendez or, you know, Kelly Kelly, who seems like she's terrified to bounce off the ropes whenever she's in there. It's possible you can have some good stuff, but you know, WWE just doesn't seem to give a shit. Richard Sanders writes in, would you agree that Triple H's storyline marriage with Stephanie McMahon was the best thing that ever happened to his career? Would he have been even close to where he is today without this storyline? Obviously, no, he would not have, and I would say that it probably was the best thing to happen to his career, but I would also throw this out there. I would say that Chyna was probably the best thing also to happen to his career, because without Chyna, I don't know that Triple H even gets to that point where they consider putting him in that storyline in the first place. You know, Triple H has always struck me as the kind of person that has always benefited from being with somebody else, whether it was with Chyna. Before that, he had Mr. Hughes as a manager for a brief period of time. You know, later on it was Stephanie, then it was Ric Flair. He's always had somebody, whether it was a manager, a mouthpiece, he's always had to be part of some sort of faction, whether it was DX or the McMahon-Helmsley faction or Evolution. All of these different, he's never been like on his own for any extended period of time, until now, I guess. But now, I mean, he doesn't have to worry about anything now. He's a made man in that company. But Chyna really added a lot of dimension to his character, and I wonder, you know, without her, I don't know. I mean, who knows? Maybe Triple H is no longer in WWE before the end of 1999. Maybe he just doesn't make it on his own. And he gets cut, and he goes to WCW. And he never even gets to that point where they say, you know what, let's put Triple H in this storyline and have him marry Stephanie McMahon. So, you know, the Stephanie storyline obviously was the biggest boon to his career. And there's no doubt he would not be at the level he's at right now without it. But let us not discount Chyna being part of his act in WWE and the big influence I think that she had on him becoming as big as he did. Matt writes in, just wanted to share a quick observation from Monday Night Raw. Before his battle with Mark Henry, CM Punk came out wearing a Jack Burton tank top from Big Trouble in Little China. That movie kicks ass. Well, hey, it's got Kurt Russell in it, so how could it not kick ass? I think I've spoken before about my love of all movies Kurt Russell, and Big Trouble in Little China would fit into that category as well. So yes, Punk is indeed a master of wearing some of the better t-shirts on Raw when he's able to work them in there. Even when he was an announcer, I think he wore the I Love Colt Cabana t-shirt where the love was the Jewish star. I thought that was rather ingenious. The fact that he was able to even get that on Raw is still amazing to me. So, yes, Punk is great. Last question here comes from Joe in Scranton, Pennsylvania. Who would you like to see on Raw as a guest host in the near future? Well, I think I've given my thoughts on this whole guest host concept before. I really don't have much of a need for it, but I will say this much. I rewatched Pulp Fiction this weekend. I haven't seen that movie in a while. Great movie, by the way, if you haven't seen it. And I would not mind seeing Samuel L. Jackson guest host Raw one of these weeks, if for no other reason, because I think he might be the key to getting these annoying what chants to end once and for all. I will sign the petition to bring Samuel L. Jackson to Raw as a guest host if he goes on Raw and uses the same quote that he used in Pulp Fiction with respect to that stupid what chant.
Say what again? Say what again? I dare you. I double dare you, motherfucker. Say what one more goddamn time.
See, now that, I think that might actually work. That's going to do it for the mailbag this week. As always, you can send questions into the Solomonster at gmail.com. Direct all inquiries to me there. If you send me questions on Facebook, no guarantee that they'll be answered on the show. So if you want to possibly get your question on the show, email me at thesolomonster@gmail.com. I have other questions I haven't gotten to. Hopefully I'll get to those next week. You can follow me on Twitter, twitter.com/Solomonster. We're building up a lot of followers there. So if you're not one of them, please get on there. Facebook.com/TheSolomonster. I'm always posting good stuff on there. You can subscribe to the show in iTunes for free. Type in Solomonster Sounds Off and subscribe and leave a review if you would be so kind. And of course, subscribe to my YouTube channel, YouTube, Username is the Solomonster, all one word. And of course, I'm going to be posting a YouTube exclusive when this show is over. The very first two episodes of the Solomonster Sounds Off from November of 2007. They're going up in one file on YouTube, YouTube only. So you have to subscribe to me on there if you want to be aware of these videos going up in the future. Otherwise, check me out on Twitter and Facebook for the link, because I'm not putting a link to the YouTube video up on SE Scoops as a separate post. Maybe I'll put it in this post for this show, but I'm not going to post separately about it. I think the fewer people that watch this, the better. But you demanded it. I'm giving it to you. Happy four-year anniversary to the show. It's been a fun 4 years. Hopefully we can get four more out of it. I enjoy doing this show every bit as much now as I did back then. It's grown, like I said earlier, to a degree that I never expected, and it's growing a little bit more each and every week thanks to you guys. Without your support, there would be no Sound Off. So on this special anniversary show, I say thank you. Be well and stay safe. We'll see you right back here next week for 190. Take it easy, guys.
Let me tell you something, fella.
This is Joe from Northern Ireland.
I am AJ Grimaldo.
And quite simply, the fastest 60 minutes on the internet.
The Solomonster Sounds Off on SEScoops.com.